Hi, everyone, and welcome to Literary Loitering, the Geek Show's dedicated books, arts, and all sorts of things like that show.
Yes, we talk about the stuff and the things.
Yes, we do. We talk about lots of stuff and lots of things, and we got lots of stuff and things today, including a person who is definitely being controlled by his hair.
Yes, yes. You have mentioned many times that the great truth behind this man.
Yes, he is being controlled by the hair. The hair is an alien. We are almost 95% sure of this.
And becoming sure with every passing day.
Yeah, and this piece of news, it kind of helps confirm it as well. It's a slow takeover of the world. It's probably the slowest takeover of the world I've seen in someone's lifetime.
It's kind of the George R. R. Martin of world takeover attempts.
I thought we agreed he's no longer George R. R. Martin.
Oh, yeah, sorry, the Gurr Martin of world takeover attempts.
Yes, yes, he is. Anyway, I am Rob, and joining me today is the wonderful Andrew.
Hello, that's who I am.
Yes, he is deliciously evil, so I give you fair warning, he does come with one of those labels that you get on music.
Warning, explicit content.
Yeah, but on yours it says, warning, delicious and evil.
But delicious evil is one of your five a day, Rob.
You're not apples.
No,
I am not making any. I am not making any jokes about bananas either.
Everyone knows the five a day are delicious evil, bacon, fat, sugar, and fatty sugar.
Yeah, he does have a point.
I do.
He does have a point. All right, okay, let's get into the news. So what are we starting with today?
We are starting with just a quick update on a story we talked about last week.
Okay.
This book is gay.
So, is it?
Yes, it is super gay. So this book is gay. It's kind of a very explicit guidebook for helping LGBT teens kind of cope with the general trials and tribulations of life.
Yeah.
But there were many complaints after the Wasilla Public Library in Alaska put it in their children's section, and a 10-year-old ended up picking it up.
Oh.
So there's been kind of lots of arguing as to whether or not it should be banned, with kind of lots of extreme views on either side. But luckily, a good compromise has been reached in that it's now been moved to the adult section instead.
Yeah.
So it's still available in the library. And I think an important point they've made is that it's not something you have to like ask for at the counter. So obviously, I think a lot of teens, they're probably going to be a bit embarrassed to like, want to walk up and actually say, do you have this book? So it's still available, but yeah. Now in a place where little kids aren't going to be going, oh, look, Mummy and Daddy, the wizards are fighting.
You went there.
I went there.
But I'm actually glad that it's been moved to the adult section and that it's not there on display for kids.
Yeah, because regardless of the LGBT thing, it's just kids shouldn't have access to something that explicit.
Well, yeah, this is the truth. They shouldn't. And I think that the problem is that the LGBT card gets played a lot these days, and it gets played a lot in order to justify things that really, you know, it's justify things that are really just trying to capitalize on the fact that there is a major issue with LGBT and that they are treated, you know, people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual or transgender are treated badly in many parts of the world. You know, it's not something that I agree with. I think that everybody should just be who they are.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I have a lot, you know, and Harry, who used to be part of the Geek Show, we love Harry. Harry Bentley, his name is. He is one of the most wonderful people you'll ever meet. Stand-up comedian, really funny guy, really sharp, really energetic, and he is gay. And we still love him because he's our friend.
Yeah, well, it's not even like that. It's a part of who they are.
Yeah. We don't see him. Thing is, we don't actually think about him being gay. Because you don't when they're your friend, when you have such a friendship with somebody, you don't think about this gender or sexuality or anything like that. They are just that person. And it puzzles me why people look at this whole idea of sexuality and gender before they look at the person.
Because some people are weird and awful.
I can understand in terms of, you know, in terms of skin color. It's kind of an obvious thing, but if I were just a random stranger and I walked up to you and said, "Hi, my name's Rob. I'd like to shake your hand, but only if you're straight."
Then, yeah, that's not good.
Do you see what I mean? You can't tell if somebody is gay or straight or transgender straight away. So I don't understand. You know, you might get to know somebody really, really well. They might become really close to you and your family. And then you find out they're gay, and that suddenly makes them a completely different person. That's not how it works.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is there are people who just, they hate anything that's even remotely different to what they are.
Yeah, people don't like change.
No, they do not.
Yeah. It's like Black Punisher during the 90s.
Yes, that is exactly applicable to this situation.
And people don't know what we're talking about. I still don't know how they got away with that.
Because Punisher, it's obviously a black man. You can tell by his pale white skin.
I know. Anyway. Moving away from the serious subject,
yes.
Because we have a tendency to get kind of passionate about these sorts of things.
We do, and it's a good cause to be passionate about.
This is true.
But we have other stories of a much less serious nature.
Shall we start off with, let's start off with Hitler.
Yes. That's lightening things. Good job, Rob.
Hitler's Mein Kampf is to be sold as an annotated edition in Germany from January. Now, it's a new edition of the text with thousands of explanatory notes, and it's going to be sold in bookshops with an initial print run limited to 4,000. And it's the first time since the Second World War that Mein Kampf will be printed in Germany, because, as I expected, it hasn't been available for public sale for a long time. So, yeah, I'm curious as to how this is going to go down, because like it or not, he is still a historical figure. And okay, yes, the Holocaust happened, but I think there's enough of a degree of separation now between now and then for people to start being able to look at things objectively.
Yeah, well, plus if like you've ever been to Berlin, you'll see they're very open about its history.
Yes.
So I think it's probably important for them to have that book there as well, to say, look, this is Hitler, this is what he thought.
Yeah, and the thing is, times have changed. We live in a connected world now. At the time when Hitler was in his rise to power and in power, the world felt like a very, very small place. Because you had telephones, but long-range communication wasn't really that good.
Yeah, like especially nothing to the degree we have now with social media, meaning you can just chat instantly to anyone in the world.
Yeah, I can talk to my little sister in Hong Kong straight away on Skype. I can see her face and talk to her properly for hours on end. And yeah, that level of communication prevents you from, you know, it basically gets rid of the whole idea of them and us, you know, and somehow they are different to us. But at the time of Hitler's rise to power and at the time of the Second World War, that wasn't the case. So I think people are intelligent enough to read the book and see it for what it is, just a work of historical interest now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main problem, though, is it's the same thing, just like why they don't have anything marking Hitler's bunker where he killed himself.
Yeah.
Is there's a worry, because obviously there are still neo-Nazi groups out there. And they may latch onto this book as kind of, well, as like a sort of Bible in a sense.
Yeah, but this is the thing. There are neo-Nazi groups, but these sorts of cults, because they are cults. That's basically all they are, is cults.
Yeah, pretty much.
They have an ideology. They follow it religiously. But at the end of the day, they are still cults. They are still just believers in a certain thing. And that thing doesn't hold water. It's basically a cult.
Yeah, basically, neo-Nazis suck. We hate them.
Yeah, well, it's not just neo-Nazis that we hate. Generally, people in cults tend to be not very nice.
Yeah. Well, I think two of the things we hate the most are people in cults and racist idiots. And neo-Nazis are kind of
both...
The melding point of the two.
Yeah, they're both racist idiots who are in a cult. You do make a very good point. I wonder if we can cause a rumble between neo-Nazis and the Klan.
A rumble in the jungle?
A rumble in a jungle.
Have we just solved I'm a Celeb to Get Me Out of Here? I think we have.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking we could also get rid of Ant and Deck at the same time. Have Ant on one side, have Deck on the other.
No, Rob, then who's going to sing the theme tune, Let's Get Ready to Rumble?
Donald Trump.
Okay, fair enough.
Donald Trump, I mean, after all, the man writes poetry.
But no, surely Donald Trump is the one who, like, looms above the Messiah-like.
He could do, but apparently he does write poetry.
Yes. Well, technically, no, he himself does not write poetry. But a book of poetry has been made consisting entirely of speeches by Donald Trump. So it's by reporter Hart Seeley.
What?
Hart Seeley.
Hart Seeley.
Yep, HARTSEELEY.
I'm sorry, but when you say Hart Seeley, it just sounds like an emoticon. Seriously, it does, doesn't it? Or some kind of weird text speak. Ruffle Hart Seeley.
No, I'm pretty sure it's just like the sequel to Kiss from a Rose.
Oh, he went there.
I did go there. I grew up in the 90s.
How many geeks think that Kiss from a Rose is the most romantic song of all time?
None, because it was used in Batman Forever.
I know.
I couldn't even say the name of the film without cringing.
Batman Forever.
Anyway, let's talk about Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Is Donald Trump a mildly less reprehensible subject than Batman Forever? No. No, it's worse, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, we already decided this was worse than Mein Kampf.
Yes.
So yeah, Hart Seeley, he's kind of composed a poetry book of Donald Trump speeches. Shall I read one?
Go on, you know you want to.
This is The Vicious Ones from Trump's 9th of August appearance on NBC's Meet the Press. I was attacked viciously by those women. Of course, it's very hard for them to attack me on looks, because I am so good-looking. But I was attacked very viciously by those women. I think we know our next poet laureate.
Oh, God, can I do the next one?
You can do the next one.
Right. The LA Times said that Trump's brilliance was on full display in the collection, quoting one which considers his doomed love of a certain junk food. Nabisco! Nabisco! Oreos, right? Oreos. I love Oreos. I'll never eat them again, okay? I'll never eat them again. No, Nabisco.
See, the audience can't see, but as Rob was reading that, just a single tear rolled down his cheek.
Yes. Oh, God. Oh, yes. God, you want to do the next one. You know you want to.
Oh, Freedom Tower.
Yes.
Yes. This is, I think, we should note about... I assume it's about the two towers, isn't
it? It's about the Freedom Tower.
Yeah, the Freedom... First one. Worst pile of crap architecture I've ever seen. Two, the terrorists win. It's that bad.
Oh, this one looks like a winner, though.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, this one's Michael Solomon, who turned Sarah Palin's emails into Hope Like Heck, the Selected Poems of Sarah Palin. Let's see how this stacks up, shall we?
I think we should.
Right, this is... Where there's smoke, and Palin's words became poetry, thanks to the talents of Michael Solomon, back in 2007. One of Lyda's aides stopped me in the hall to say the building was getting a kick out of my burnt toast episode this morning that caused the fire alarms to go off for 20 minutes and caused an evacuation. She thought it was funny I was cooking breakfast in the Capitol and burnt it. I assured her I was not in the building this morning. I was not cooking breakfast here at any time, and I did not burn any toast. She looked at me warily. I doubt she believed me.
Ten out of ten, masterpiece.
Yes. Performance poetry. So, yeah, it's not the first time that would-be politicians, because they're not actual politicians, are they?
No, no, they're not.
Well, no, Sarah Palin was a politician, Donald Trump wasn't, but...
Yeah, Donald Trump is just a crazy man.
But they're both nuts, so let's just stick with would-be politicians.
Yes.
It's not the first time that would-be politicians have had their comments turned into poetry. I'm curious, though, how would this work with, say, David Cameron? Let's have a look. Famous quotes by David Cameron. It's got to be done.
And I feel like one would just be, oink, oink, squeal, squeal.
Oink, oink.
That's how Daddy makes the bacon.
Oh, you are a horrible man.
I know. What's bad is I come from a very loving home. I'm just crazy and evil.
Yes. And delicious. Don't forget the delicious. I just wanted to make a t-shirt now that just says, I am delicious. Right, funny quotes from David Cameron. At a time when we're having to take such difficult decisions about how to cut back without damaging the things that matter the most, we should strain every sinew to cut error, waste, and fraud.
See, I'm envisioning this more as freestyle rap.
Yeah. Let me see if I can turn this one into poetry.
Oh, God.
And just give me a sec.
This can only end well.
Cap the well. Yes. Clear up the mess. Yes. Make compensation. Yes. Absolutely. But would it be right to have legislation that independently targets BP rather than other companies? I don't think that would be right.
I think we need a book of David Cameron poetry now as well.
So, yes. Here's a good one. A very, very short one. I know British people. And they are not passengers. They are drivers. Sorry, I'm emphasizing the wrong words on purpose.
It's like the Tommy Wiseau school of poetry.
Yes, it is. I've seen performance poets and they just have this thing where they emphasize certain words and just kind of, you do kind of know that, I'll just go with it. Just chill. Just relax. I'm not going to criticize. It's your interpretation of the Haggis address. Can you imagine a performance poet doing the Haggis address? Or the Haggis address done as interpretive dance?
Yeah. No, better than that. I want to see George Osborne's annual budget report as interpretive dance.
Oh, God, yes.
Just popping and locking with the red box.
Yes. Anyway, Donald Trump's poetry. Are you interested in more of these?
I am, yes. I want more crazy Donald Trump poetry.
See, I think that somebody should really do a book of poetry based on George W. W. poetry. Yeah. Dub poetry. There we go. There's a title for it. Just a picture of him on the front going. Yeah.
Pouty lip pose.
Yes. George W. Bush going for a walk would be W step.
Oh.
Yes.
I knew it was coming and it was still a disappointment.
Yes, I know. I know.
I think I misunderestimated how bad that would be.
Yes, you misunderestimated that a lot. Anyway, shall we move on?
Yes, let's.
Let's move on to Morrissey. It's time for some Morrissey.
Oh, no.
You know you want to.
I do want to. So this is a story we've kind of... We've been waiting for a few weeks now.
Yes.
We finally have the winner for the Bad Sex Award.
Yes.
And it's Morrissey for his debut novel, List of the Lost.
Yeah. I read the scene earlier. I'm going to let you do this one now.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, I've just made up poetry on the spot.
Oh, boy. This is... Just try not to get aroused, everyone. At this, Eliza and Ezra roll together in one giggling snowball of full-figured copulation, screaming and shouting as they playfully bit and pulled at each other in a dangerous and clamorous rollercoaster coil of sexually violent reaction. Oh, God. Oh, sorry, sexually violent rotation with Eliza's breasts rolled over his. Yeah. What? What kind of Star Fox nonsense is this?
That's why I wanted you to read it.
Rolled across Ezra's howling mouth.
Just
and the pained frenzy of his bulbous salutation extenuating his excitement as it whacked and smacked its way into every muscle of Eliza's. Every muscle of Eliza's body, except for the otherwise central zone. Oh, boy. I'm flushed. I think I need a cigarette now.
Feel better now?
I do. But, oh. It's not just that scene.
No.
Because obviously this is a competition.
Yes.
And there was some stiff competition that it had to beat out.
Oh, God, yes. What was it?
Well, the shortlist includes The Martini Shot by George Pelicanos, who wrote The Wire.
Yes.
I wrote myself against her until she was wet as a water slide.
Oh, no. Joshua Cohen's Book of Numbers. Her breasts were like young fawns, sheep frolicking in hyssop.
And Before, During, After by Richard Bausch. When she took him, still a little flaccid, into her mouth, he moaned, "Oh, lover!"
I love awards like these. It's like the, what was it? It's the, you know, the worst title.
Yeah.
The worst book title. Some of those have been amazing. Me and Andy have been talking about them on the show for several years now, but there are just some amazing titles, and people people misunderstand them. People do misunderstand them. There was one called Cooking with Pooh. But Pooh is actually a woman's name from Southeast Asia. I think it was from Thailand or somewhere like that.
Oh, I bet there were many disappointed amateur chefs there.
Yes, there were. And many kids who thought they'd get to cook with Pooh Bear.
See, if I was a good person, that's where my mind would have gone.
Yes, then seeing a middle-aged Asian woman on the cover going, "That don't look like Winnie the Pooh."
Well, maybe Winnie the Pooh the later years.
Yeah, but this is the thing. You know, the difference between kids and adults is our brains work very differently to kids.
Yes, so yes, ours do.
In our world, there is a thing called euphemism.
Well, yes, I know all about euphemism. It's like a dangerous and clamorous rollercoaster coil of sexually violent rotation.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But yeah, we have this thing called euphemism in the world of adults. And any kids listening to this show at the moment, you might want to turn your heads and walk away right now, because I'm about to ruin your childhood. There was an advert on TV several years ago, and I burst out laughing. I almost spat my coffee out, because it was for this thing called Book of Pooh, and it was all about Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah, but it's still called Book of Pooh.
But the advert was selling it, and whoever was narrating the advert had the most knowing voice I've ever heard on an advert for a kid's product or a kid's TV show. And you could tell they were trying so hard not to start laughing. And this advert was basically recorded like that. And so it was repeated. And every time I heard it, it was just kind of, yeah. I can hear it in your voice. You just try straining not to laugh and go, "Why have you got it?"
Oh, was he straining hard?
Yes, he was straining hard. But that wasn't the worst one. The worst one was the Shake, Rattle, and Ride poo.
Oh, no.
It even had a song. Oh. Shake, rattle, and ride, poo.
Oh, that's not good at all.
Thing is, that one was an advert. It was a product sold over here, Winnie the Pooh thing. And the advert had obviously been made in America because it didn't register at all. They played it completely straight, which made it worse when it came over here. And I didn't notice this one. My nephew, who was, I think he was about 4 years old at the time, and had just learned that poo was a funny word.
It's like one of the most important lessons of childhood.
Yes. And he was the one who ran up. He's like, Uncle, Uncle, they've got this funny advert on. I look at the advert and I went, okay, I get it. It's funny. He went, isn't that really funny? They're talking about riding poo. This is a 4 year old boy.
He gets it.
Yes, he does. So yeah, words are funny.
Words are very funny.
Interpretations are funny. Normally it would be adults who look at those sorts of things and go, yeah, that's really funny, because we've basically engaged the euphemistic side of our brain and gone, ha, 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 ha.
Basically, when we get to adulthood, we just get more immature.
Yeah, I'm officially, I reckon I've got a mental age. When my euphemism brain kicks in, my mental age is probably about 6.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I get that. All throughout GCSE history, we did the history of medicine, and there's one very influential German doctor called Robert Koch.
Yep.
Like, and we couldn't stop laughing.
Yep.
Like, and literally, this was like just an entire year of every time it was mentioned.
Was that because his name was Dr. Bob Koch?
Yes, yes.
Yes, I went there. Anyway, the Bad Sex Award. We'll be back next year.
Yay, thank
with
goodness.
With more amazing entries. And I said that on purpose.
Oh, Lord.
But that's not the last story. The last story, and I found this by accident. This is apparently a photography story. And
yes,
we do talk about the arts. And
this is the serious arts part.
Yeah, this is the serious arts part. And it's not.
No.
I'm not sure how to start this story, but I'm going to just try and do it. A team of data scientists, designers, and researchers have collected 152,462 pictures tagged within a 5 kilometre area around Somerset House in London over the period of 1 week, 640 of which were deemed to be selfies. Right? Now, from these 640, they have worked out that Londoners in general take selfies that are glummer, less tilted, and more bespectacled than people in Berlin, New York, Sao Paulo, Moscow, and Bangkok. Using facial recognition software and ranking the most happy as 1 and the least as 0, London selfies were found to have a score of 0.55 compared with the average of 0.62 across those other cities, which means that Londoners are glummer than those other cities. But they also found that more people wearing glasses in London take selfies, and those selfies tend to be less tilted. You know how in lots of other countries they hold the camera up there?
Yeah, yeah, and then do the pouty duck face.
Yes, the pouty duck face. But in this country, they just tend to go like that.
Yes, because we are more. No, there's nothing. I can't positive spin this.
It's the action shot. We don't do the action shot, no, do we? You know, we don't do. What we've got is this weird thing where we get some photographer to take photos of us while we're on a night out, and then that photographer will basically add these weird streaky light effects on it to make it look as though, oh, it's an action shot. You're like, it's been photoshopped to look like that, because I was there that night and there wasn't anything like that there. I don't remember anything
like
this.
Yes, I just didn't remember all the nights out I've got on where there haven't been random streaks of light throughout the air.
Yeah, I know. And I don't know why they had them, because they just ruined the photo. Like, you caught my best side. It's the first time I've looked good on a camera in decades.
And you've ruined it.
You've ruined it by covering me with light.
I mean, obviously, I am just naturally luminescent, but I understand how this is a problem for mortals.
Yes, yes, it is. It's a problem for mortals like me who don't do cameras.
Well, no, because they steal your soul. It's a documented fact.
I have one shot. I have my limit of one photo per decade. and I have to get really dressed up for it. You know, I have to look smart. I'm clean shaven, hair is cut. You know, I've been to the gym for 6 months beforehand, so I look buff instead of my normal state of fluff. And I pause for that one photo, and then they cover it in light swirls and stuff like that. And they've taken the photo at an angle, or they put it at an angle just to make it look actiony and jaunty. And they ruin it, man. It's my one good photo in a decade.
Sure, I feel like your main problem here is waiting to take your one photo per decade to do it with a group of like 18-year-old girls.
No, it's usually just my mates.
Yes, and like I said, 18-year-old girls.
I don't know any 18-year-old girls.
Good. You shouldn't. They're weird, Rob. I have one for a sister.
Okay. I have a 16-year-old niece. Does that count?
Close enough.
Yeah, but she's a martial artist now. She's more a martial artist than anything else, to be honest.
Okay, no, probably not close enough then.
Yeah. Because she doesn't do the whole clubbing thing or anything like that. And the last time some guy tried hitting on her, she hit back. So yeah, anyway, yes, selfies, back to selfies. What do you think of selfies in general?
I guess in general, like, I don't mind them. It's like, you know, if you're out, you're having a good time, you want to take a picture of yourself, go ahead. And like, obviously I don't agree with the whole ridiculous duck face hashtag no filter hashtag YOLO type stuff that goes on.
Yeah, I don't understand the whole hashtag YOLO hashtag duck face hashtag no filter thing. What the hell does no filter mean?
Means there's no filter on the shot, maybe?
Why would they put a filter on the shot?
I don't know. Do I look like the kind of guy who runs around taking selfies of myself?
No. Andrew, I think we should summon our in-house expert on selfies.
Fine, I'll start the ancient incantation.
Okay.
Ryan, get over here. Okay, done.
That's how you know when I'm here, because it's just a sigh.
Yes. Okay, so selfies. What's so good about selfies? And what does hashtag no filter, hashtag YOLO, hashtag what was the other one?
I think the other one was just hashtag selfie.
One at a time. Right, which one do you want me to answer first?
Okay, what is hashtag no filter?
Hashtag no filter. For example, with apps such as Instagram or various other type of apps where, you know, you take a selfie and they often have things like filters on, which, you know, can make it look cool. And hashtag no filter is where you just, you know, just take the picture and just upload it as is. And you're basically just specifying that there's no filter on that. So hashtag no filter.
Yeah, okay.
You have a question, Rob?
Yes, I have a question. How can you take a photo with Instagram? I thought you took a photo with a camera.
No, I'm saying you're taking the photo, but you're using the app Instagram as a means to do so.
But you need to use a camera.
Yeah, you're using the phone. You're using the phone, and the app is just a way to, you know, upload there, and it also has all the filters and all the editing software in there as well.
Okay, right, okay, I get it. So what is hashtag YOLO?
It's like, well, it means you only live once, so it's just sort of like, yeah, I don't care, whatever, just live free. I don't know, I'm not going too deep into it.
Chili is like the exact opposite of the attitude you should have. Like, you know, you only live once, don't waste things. Drinking alcohol, that might kill you. Like, never leave the house, board up all the windows.
That's my point. If you
that's
only
what the
live...
Lonely Islands told me to
but,
do.
Yeah, but YOLO.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. If you only live once, surely you'd be more careful. You know, can you imagine going up to jump out of deck a first parachute jump? And you're like, hashtag YOLO. And you're like, actually, that's a good point. Maybe I shouldn't do this.
Also, I like the irony that while we're talking about this, Ryan is wearing a one-up t-shirt.
Oh, God. Such awkwardness.
He got you there.
Yep. I don't help myself at all. Is there any other questions you want answering?
Yes. We've got this story here. London selfies are apparently glummer, less tilted and more bespectacled than those taken in Berlin, New York, Sao Paulo, Moscow, Bangkok and various other cities in the world.
Okay.
So what do you think of those results? It's a study that has actually found that selfies in London, which by extension means that selfies around here are probably not going to be much, not going to be better.
Have you seen my Instagram, Rob? Please.
Yeah, but you're like, you've got a level of fabulousness.
I'm over 9,000.
Yeah, you've got a level of fabulousness that doesn't fit with this town.
Yes, I actually will agree with that.
So what do you think in general?
So are they trying to say, like, just
they just people on these photos. They use facial recognition to rank these photos,
right?
And they're basically saying that people in London tend to look at when they're taking selfies. They don't tend to angle them as much as other countries. Okay. They don't tend to smile as much at the camera, and a lot more people wear glasses.
But to refer to the last one, people who wear glasses are smarter and better looking than everyone else, which is just, you know, documented fact.
This is true.
Well, often my selfies, I do the tilt and often no facial expression. So I have elements of that. I don't know. Just so, YOLO, man.
If you do no facial expressions, is there a hashtag for no facials? Hashtag no facials.
It's just...
I know.
It's just my face, Rob. I can't help it. I'm going to start hashtagging that now.
Hashtag no facials.
What have you done, Rob?
You've just added, like, just another hashtag to my already, like, paragraphs of hashtags.
Oh, Ryan's going to get the wrong crowd heading to his Instagram.
Any publicity is better than no publicity. That's how I look at it.
This is true. This is because you're a nice boy.
We're gonna
end the news there. So we shall unsummon Ryan now. What was the chant again?
Ryan, go away. He's been banished from whence he came.
Right. Okay. Now after that magical interlude, what's next?
Well, I think we're going to take a regular good old interlude now.
Yes. 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 We'll be back after this message.
Hello. Do you like films? Well, wow, that's good. We're over the first hurdle. If you like films, and you also like podcasts, you should probably check out the Geek Show's only dedicated movie podcast, Cinema Eclectica. Well-staffed with a trained array of helper monkeys, we review all of the latest films every week, and do it reasonably well.
And welcome back to Literary Loitering. We are back now, and Rob is going to talk about a book, what he has actually read with his eyes and what such.
Yes, I did actually read this with my eyes and what such, and I processed it with my brain, and I didn't use my finger at all.
Well done.
So, yes. Anyway, this is The Watchman of Eternity by Paul Whitcover, which is, if I remember rightly, it is book two in the Productions of Time.
Yes, I would assume so, since you did book one last week.
Yes. Now, this picks up where the last book left off. At the end of the last book, and this is a spoiler for anybody who hasn't read the book, so just be careful. At the end of the last book, Lord Withcutt had basically been beaten senseless because Daniel Quare wasn't the only person after the Hunter Clock, right? And Lord Withcutt and Grim Alkin, Daniel Quare, and also, Thomas Aylesford, he was also on this trail. Now, this has a lot to do with the Jacobites now as well, because Thomas Aylesford is basically a very, very violent man, and he is basically working for Bonnie Prince Charlie, and he is after the clock to help Bonnie Prince Charlie take the throne and also help the French defeat the English, but he doesn't trust the French at all. And this book starts off with Aylesford and his travelling companion, whose name I have forgotten.
Oh, that guy. He's my favourite.
Yes. Yeah, Aylesford and his travelling companion, who is not really as trustworthy as Aylesford thinks. They are on a ship, travelling across the channel, and suddenly a storm hits. And Aylesford does not do well on ships. He's already vomited pretty much everything that's in his stomach, only to find out that his traveling companion comes in, barricades himself, both the two of them in the room, and says, there's a mutiny on the ship. The captain is dead, and they're coming for us. He goes, well, why? He says, because you're a bloody idiot, and you challenged the captain to a duel when the captain didn't say anything. And then Aylesford basically says, he was staring at me with his eyes, and he called me a liar. And you're like, well, no, you imagine that. But I heard it. No, you imagine that as well.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Aylesford is a bloody nut job. But that's what makes him work as a character. The fact that he is. The fact that he's got so much anger that it's enough to overcome his seasickness. Stuff like that. It makes it work. And Aylesford is also the person who cut off Daniel Quare's hand.
So he's got a reason to be a bit mad then.
Well, he was mad to start off with, but in the race for the Hunter Clock, which is now in Aylesford's possession, and which he bragged about as well, when he wasn't supposed to be telling anybody, in the race for the clock, he actually managed to catch Daniel Quare unawares and cut off his hand. Daniel Quare has since disappeared, and Lord Withcott is still recovering from his wounds. He was severely wounded. There's no sign of Grimalkin either. So, yeah, Quare's lost his hand. Nobody knows if he's still alive or dead. Aylesford thinks he's dead. Moving on. I'm going to leave it there because I don't want to ruin this book, because this is following on from The Emperor of All Things, but this is actually getting better as it goes along. This series is definitely getting better as it goes along. The characters are a lot more vibrant now. After the first book, the characters were really starting to come to life by the end of the first book, and it was really, things were really starting to heat up. The action was really played out very, very well. It's very descriptive. And then this book basically launches straight into it with a really, I'm actually just going to read this, right? Because I found an excerpt of it online. I'm just going to read this. This is just the first paragraph of chapter one. Just to give you an idea of how descriptive this book can be, but how gloriously descriptive, not bland. The lugger lurched and groaned. Aylesford followed suit, rolling to the side to spew into the bucket that had been the trustworthy receptacle of his sickness until now. But the bucket, too, had lurched aside, and the depleted contents of his stomach spattered in a thin gruel over the wooden slats of the floor. The lantern, swinging madly from the low ceiling, flung its meagre light across the cabin in a haphazard manner that made him feel as if the vessel had already come apart, shaken to pieces by the squall that had struck midway across the channel.
Damn!
Do you see what I mean about gloriously descriptive? Yeah.
I think I loved it. Like, as soon as you said, Aylesworth followed suit.
Yes.
Like, that's a really clever bit.
Yep. It's that kind of descriptiveness in the book and all the way across. And when it comes to the actual fight scenes, the detail is almost caressing the action. It's that good. I'm rapidly becoming a big fan of Paul Whitcover, because just from two books, it really is good. And historically, it's kind of accurate historically. So it does work within the realms of historical fiction. You know, obviously, the Worshipful Company of Clockmakers, they are still a force to be reckoned with, but Aylesford is nuts, and things don't go the way everyone thinks they're going to go in these books. There are lots of political intrigue, lots of backstabbing, lots of betrayal, and basically just the usual kind of things that you'd expect in a 18th century French court.
Which I assume is where some of the things happen in.
Yes. Well, this is basically, you know, it's 1758, is it? Or something like that. I can't remember the date. Yeah, I can't remember the date. But it's basically directly after the first book, which I think was 1758. So it's the middle of the 18th century. And yeah, oh God, got to read this to you. Just one more bit from this book. Really good. He wished he'd never set foot aboard this ship with its unlucky name. He'd been told it had been christened after Captain Bagot's eldest son. But the instant he heard the name, he'd crossed himself, for Pierre meant stone as well. And now the smuggler's craft seemed certain to sink like one. Only the French would tempt fate so frivolously, as if the good fortune were their birthright and the elements themselves must bow to their every whim. They were a different breed of human, he sometimes thought, a fairy-touched race whose follies were inseparable from their glories. He both admired and resented them, always conscious of how completely his suppliant nation relied upon the support of a people by nature capricious and not to be trusted, save in one thing only, their implacable hatred of England.
Oof. Frivolous and capricious in the same paragraph.
And implacable.
And implacable, that's... I think I might become a fan of this if I read it.
Yes, I think you'd be a fan of this as well. It's that good. It is a great sequel to The Emperor of All Things, and it really ramps up the tension and the stakes as well, because the Hunter Clock is basically a weapon that can really change the whole war, the outcome of the war between France and England, who is going to be king? Is it going to be Bonnie Prince Charlie or not? You know, are the Jacobites going to succeed or not? That is the thing. You know, or will the French succeed? Who is going to win?
Yeah, because obviously being a fantasy novel, it's not necessarily going to go the same way that history actually does.
Yeah, exactly. But then again, it might. But it might just put that fantasy sheen over the top of things and say, this is what actually happened. So this is history as you know it, but this is history as you didn't know it.
Yeah, it's also completely viable. You don't know.
Exactly. And I love the fact that it's going down that route. I think Paul Whitcover's written a very, very intelligent novel here. And it really builds on what was put down in the solid foundation that was laid down in The Emperor of All Things. It's a very, very good sequel, and I am loving it.
Good stuff. So do I even need to ask if it's recommended?
You don't need to ask, because it is highly recommended. You definitely need to read The Emperor of All Things first. But once you've finished it, you're in for a hell of a ride in The Watchmen of Eternity.
Well, you say that. Aren't both books kind of about timey-wimey shenanigans?
Yes.
So surely you should read them, like, the second one, then the third one, then the first one.
No, because this ain't Doctor Who. Although, given that it's all about clocks and stuff like that, I reckon Doctor Who fans would really like this. I reckon Doctor Who fans would really like this series. In fact, anybody who's interested in time travel and time and stuff like that, or just steampunk in general, should read these books, because this is a very, very, very kind of fantasy-oriented steampunk type.
Well, it's kind of like pre-steampunk steampunk.
Yeah, pre-steampunk steampunk with powdered wigs and beauty marks.
What's not to love about that?
Yes, and an 18th, an 18th century French courts.
Which are like the best courts.
Yes. Do you know what Aylesford calls... sorry. Just one last bit. Aylesford was no fool. French policy was determined not in the council chambers, but in the boudoirs of Versailles, where the whore Pompadour pulled the strings and of her puppet king.
That's a good line.
So, yeah, I'm just going to leave you with that. It's that good a book. So, yeah, I think we're pretty much at the end of the show with that as well.
Yep, we can end it here.
Yeah. So, that's The Watchmen of Eternity, book two in the Productions of Time by Paul Whitcover. Highly recommended, but read The Emperor of All Things first. Very quickly, just a few messages before we go. If you want to get in touch with us, studio@thegeekshow.co.uk, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, My Animalist, various places like that. If you want to support us, you can do so by buying one of our lovely t-shirts from our new and improved shop, or you can simply use the donate button on the side. And yeah, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
We'll see you all next week.
See ya.